Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast. I'm delighted to welcome our very special guest this week, Fern Potter, EVP and Global Strategy Officer for FCB6. Hello, Fern.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
We're delighted to have you. And I was just highly entertained by our pre-recording chat where Fern was sharing with me that she's basically turned into a country bumpkin.
It's true. I'm over it. I'm staying rural, I think, now.
Why not?
Yeah, got the dog, got the car, so I'm quite happy.
Did you actually, that's a good question, did you live in the countryside before COVID came along or not?
I've been in London. Yeah, London 8 years, and I was in Sydney as well for 4 years before that, so pretty much.
Wow, you made the COVID move to the countryside.
I've done it, and there's no regrets yet. Yeah, I don't know. It might be a bit of FOMO if people start getting back into Soho and, you know, the marketing and ad tech world start, the events start coming back in.
And I reckon less the FOMO, it'll be the first time that you have to attend something in the West End and then scrabble to get a train home at X time in the evening and, you know, deal with not falling asleep and missing your stop and winding up somewhere much further in the countryside than where you actually live.
It's true. Yeah, that could happen.
And not in the countryside, but, you know, rural enough for us Londoners over in the Waltham Stowe Studios, Lindsay Rowntree.
Rural enough because I live by some wetlands.
Yes. Yes. And also because sometimes you struggle to get, what was it, Deliveroo?
Yeah. We are quite cut off around here. It's very strange. It's better now, and the pandemic has obviously helped, but I think there's a mental block, well, not a mental, a physical block with companies that we are the other side of a bunch of reservoirs, so we're just kind of isolated from the rest of East London. Pretty rubbish.
That was the biggest thing to get accustomed to, moving out of London. It's like, how do I feed myself? I'm reliant on delivery services.
And what's the answer, Fern? What have you found?
I've had to learn to cook. It's been terrible.
Oh, God. It's difficult. There's got to be a gap in the market for Deliveroo-style services for rural locations, because surely more people, well, firstly, more people are at home all the time, and so there's more opportunities, and secondly, probably more people are moving outside of cities for the moment.
No, I think so, because that kind of, I think, you know, we're going to see a shift in commuting and that commute about widening perhaps, and that actually these services probably need to be a little bit more rural focused as experiences change kind of up and down the country. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see if they start, I might start a campaign to get Shropshire serviced by some kind of delivery system, or maybe just get a van.
Well, start it yourself in your discovery, and you know, and with the dog. I'm sure people would appreciate that, actually, friendly country bumpkin deliveries. Anyway, I digress. Listeners, I don't know why we've dived into this flavor of conversation so early on. So let's instead talk about news of the week in ad tech and martech. First news story I wanted to raise with you guys is Reach PLC, UK News Media and Digital Publishing Group, reported some quite positive results from Q4 of 2020 this week. So a better than expected overall result for the year, which was 130 to 135 million profit, up from an anticipated 122 million, which was reported or forecast rather in Q3 last year. Q4 saw online revenues grow by 25%, up from 13% in Q3. So that's quite a big jump from quarter to quarter. And the company also reached a really interesting milestone in December of last year, which was 5 million online users or customer registrations. And that's really interesting because it's a kind of key component of the development of the company's customer insight platform, which is called Reach ID. So this is their attempt to develop a single view of customers across all of their properties and all of their sites. And that sign-in process or login process appears to be going quite well. So it's not all good news, of course, because this is the world of the pandemic. And actually, there's still an overall decline in revenues in 2020 compared to 2019, which is more or less a direct result of the pandemic. And the revenues, the loss in revenues has really come from their print business. So digital business is up, but it hasn't entirely compensated for the loss in revenues of their print business. So really interested to hear what the two of you think of this as a news story. We've talked a lot over the last 12 months about what publishers need to do to prepare themselves for a cookieless world. Could we perhaps see that, the Reach ID solution is a really viable proposition, not just for Reach as a publishing group, but potentially for other publishing groups? This is an example of this working well and then being very well prepared for a post-cookie world. And in general, what do you think it says about, the future for digital revenues for publishing groups? Fern, I'll come to you first.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting. I think for too long there's been this kind of the focus on the ad revenue model has been to the detriment sometimes of customer experience and publishers. So actually moving into a logged in environment enables you to get brands to have really, really concise contextual targeting with audience in mind, giving some great experience, which will lend itself to greater publisher revenues. And also it avoids the impact of what we've got in subscription fatigue from people, where you're having to try and access content behind a paywall that isn't essentially going to be beneficial to the revenue model. So I think it's really smart, and it's going to provide a really good relevant bed for advertisers to create some awesome experiences on the Reach network.
And that was another thing that I was wondering about, actually, is this a much more compelling proposition potentially for advertisers? Because, not only have they perhaps got a better view of the customer in that Reach environment, but maybe it's also helping with issues like transparency. They've got a much sort of clearer path, if you like, to that publisher inventory.
Yeah, I would say so. I think it enables us to know a lot more about who we're talking to, who we're advertising to, and then, within the right context, it enables you to have a real kind of great verification in the brand safety element of it as well. And what I quite like about it is something we've just talked about actually on the entry, is that they've got rural titles, they've got, national press as well. There's just such a range there that I think that unified view is going to be really interesting as we start talking a little bit more about the sprawl of people outside of cities and metro areas.
Lindsay, what's your opinion?
Yeah, to echo Fern's point about the kind of the rural titles, the fact they've got so much local news. And I think that during the pandemic, probably they haven't gone, I haven't seen any detail about where the revenue numbers are coming from or where the readership numbers are coming from. And obviously they've got big titles like Daily Express, the Mirror and OK Magazine as well. But I feel like I read somewhere last year that there's a huge surge in local news and specific digital news, to the point where many local newspapers that would normally have like a once a week thing that comes out, I remember the town I'm from, every Thursday the Alton Herald will come out, pop out and buy it and see what's going on in the local town. The demand for local news, from things like what's going on in my local hospital to where can I buy toilet paper to just actually being interested in my local community, because normally I don't care about it because I'm commuting into London or whatever, but now I actually care about what's going on around me. There's been a huge surge, and I think Nottinghamshire Live, which actually is a Reach publication, saw its highest single month numbers ever in October, and it was 25 million page views, which for a local newspaper is probably massive. And I think that you've got with local news, you'll have a growing younger demographic going to them that probably weren't before, but also you've probably got increased digitization of the older demographic that maybe can't go out to get their newspaper, and those that have probably got internet or become more internet savvy during the pandemic to keep in touch with family are now using online mechanisms and online means to be able to go and look at local news. So I think that that's probably kind of give Reach a massive, massive boost. And it's, I guess, post-pandemic is how they maintain that. And if there's a stronger kind of working from home impetus across the country, there's probably a good opportunity there. And I think that this Reach ID across their entire portfolio of newspapers, because you'll have people that read the Daily Express and OK and their local site as well, will give Reach, you know, unprecedented insight into what their users are doing and who they are.
Mm. It offers up a lot of opportunity for the ways in which, as you've alluded to there, Lindsay, the ways in which they could organise their digital assets as well. So, you know, knowing a lot more about who is consuming their content and then being able to cater that content from a geographical point of view, you know, so therefore being able to work out that they can invest more in local news or local content could sort of, you know, I mean, that could kind of revolutionise the world of local media and local press and actually revive some elements of that industry, which, you know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago was probably seen as a little bit of a dying industry.
No, I was going to say I completely agree. I think there's going to definitely be opportunities for brands to create a lot more relevant experiences within those environments as well. And it's funny that we were talking about the fact previously that kind of radio has been the only way to really capture local, which is great from an audio perspective, but obviously not from the visual. So enabling these kind of digital assets in the rural areas, it's not like you can get out of home around here. It's going to create a lot of opportunities for more visual and video content going forwards.
Yeah, I think it was maybe partway through last year, we had Terry Hornsby, who's the Group Digital Director at Reach, on one of our podcasts. And sort of in the informal chat prior to the podcast, I was saying to him, well, you know, because this was sort of, do you remember those heady days where it was all a little bit of a novelty, this pandemic business, and the conversation, opening conversation to every meeting was also how you're coping with everything. And I remember one of the first things he said is, we have never had higher traffic or been busier in all of our lives. And he said, we're just kind of trying to work out what to do with it all. I mean, not that they didn't, you know, literally know what to do with it, but he really sort of spoke of this feeling of a big boost and a kind of that was inspiring them to really think about ways that they would do things differently. At the time, they were in the midst of trying to build the Reach ID. So, you know, I'm sure that gave them lots of inspiration to get on with it, really. It's great to have, you know, to have something tangible that's positive to attach to the, you know, to the publishing industry, right? For so long in digital media, we've been talking about negativity associated with publishing businesses. It's nice that maybe the tide is turning a little.
Yeah, I think it really helps with how the individual Reach as a company, but how the individual publishers within that can interact with their audience as well. And I remember the conversation we had with Paul Hood, working at News UK, in a podcast kind of quite sort of the beginning of the pandemic, talking about how they were interacting with their customers in new ways, looking at their different kind of sports titles or their different how they were interacting with the community and trying to build a community. I think Reach can do that, particularly through its local and rural publications as well. And I think it'll be a boon for local media's reputation, but also just generally, I think will spell untold opportunities for companies like Reach that do have these more local titles. And I think that's gonna be interesting. I think you'll see them buying more of them next year.
Moving on to second news story of the week, a really interesting blog post that was posted on a blog site called Mobile Dev Memo, pondering what is going to happen to the world of digital advertising should Facebook be broken up. So, of course, the sort of premise for this story is all of the anti-competition and antitrust lawsuits that are being brought against Facebook in the US and whether they might actually result in the breakup of Facebook, Instagram and WhatsApp. The notion being that part of the allegations made against Facebook is that they used their dominance in the industry unfairly to knock out the competition by acquiring them and offering them sums that couldn't be refused. And the article focuses a little bit on what the value of each of those properties would be if they were to be separated altogether. The notion being that, you know, advertising revenue for Instagram is huge. That's the main, obviously main part of their business. And that that advertising, that personalized advertising, is fueled by Facebook data. So if the companies are separated and they're not able to share data across those platforms anymore, what does that do to Instagram? What does that do to Instagram's ability to deliver targeted advertising? WhatsApp have changed their terms and conditions and are asking users to sign up to those refreshed terms and conditions. And there's lots of sort of pondering and debate about the degree to which Facebook are now going to be more explicitly sharing user data across those platforms. And we've, you know, interestingly here at ExchangeWire, because we're keen users of messaging app Telegram, noticed so many people flocking to alternative messaging services over the last couple of weeks, which we think has been fueled by the WhatsApp developments. So views from you guys on that. Lindsay, let's start with you.
I think the article that was referenced for this, kind of how breaking them up would affect advertisers, particularly advertisers investing in Instagram, actually was a really interesting insight that I hadn't really thought of. And Fern, I'm actually going to be fascinated to hear what you have to say about it as someone that's probably closer to it and potentially having these conversations with your clients as well. Mm-hmm. I feel like the interesting thing is, you know, where if you were to break Instagram and Facebook up, where would Instagram be today if it weren't for Facebook? So talking about why Instagram is what it is, and you have to think about it from the like, would advertisers have invested in Instagram the way they do today if it weren't for Facebook in the first place, which would then kind of give you an argument as to why you maybe wouldn't necessarily want to break them up. And actually there could be billions wiped off of advertiser revenue globally if you do break them out, because how are advertisers going to be able to get the same value for investing in Instagram as they currently can through Facebook? And you can say what you like about Facebook and the targeting, the way Facebook uses data. You've got the Facebook pixel, you've got the way that Facebook tracks even non-Facebook users across the internet, how it tracks you across apps, and obviously the fact that it can tie data together through WhatsApp, Instagram and Facebook as well, makes it really easy for advertisers to be able to access data and be able to target people on Instagram. And if you think that maybe from Facebook's perspective, Instagram is a really, really powerful tool for them, because where Facebook has come under a lot of fire, Instagram has been able to kind of remain largely separate from that backlash. And despite the fact that you can actually advertise on both of them at the same time and you're using the same Facebook data to target on Instagram, it's kind of been thought of as very separate, particularly from an advertiser perspective, probably because the results that advertisers get from Instagram is so strong and so positive. And there's so much development happening in Instagram, and there's obviously just still a massive and growing user base of Instagram across different generations too. There's also kind of the older demographic starting to use it as well, so it's becoming an even more interesting place for advertisers to be able to go to. Break them up instantly, it's more work for advertisers, and they have to then start doing a second job by you know, you talk about it from kind of the old school paid search. Google got the love, and Microsoft and Yahoo, you know, no one bothered because it was just too much effort. Yeah. For small audience size. Now Instagram won't suffer from small audience size, you would hope, but it does make it more difficult for advertisers in the first place, just having to do everything twice or do it through a different platform. And then how do they target in the same way? Well, for them, it could mean they're paying lower CPMs to get a user, but only because they've got kind of fewer targeting options. So it could actually save them money as advertisers that they could put somewhere else. Or it could mean they just don't invest in Instagram at all. But that's just kind of speculating based on how I know brands use Instagram at the moment and kind of what the benefit of it is from small businesses like direct to consumer businesses and local businesses to the kind of the large big multinational corporations. It's an interesting concept, the fact that actually breaking them up could cause a huge, maybe detrimental economic impact.
Yeah, it's I think to your point, Lindsay, it's so interesting that there is actually the ease to market is something that has always traditionally kind of swayed advertising dollar. And it's the same across Google, right? It's like, if you can get in all those entities, let's do that and let's do it with ease. That is quite lazy, though. And I think the different platforms have their customer usage, their customer base is very different. You go on Facebook for very different reasons to why you go on Instagram. And so kind of ticking the box to transfer that experience over doesn't really kind of help brands with the user experience. So I think brands are used to having fragmentation across their channels. Attribution is going to be tricky when you've got all these walled gardens, and if they continue to fragment, that's going to be quite interesting. But I think it will create great customer experience and great direct brand experiences with customers. So on Facebook, you've got a lot of you know, it is about the sharing, it is about marketplace and how they localize that element that's become a big revenue generator for them. Instagram, you've got more of the social it's, you know, more photogenic streaming commerce, et cetera, that will go into it. And the audience, as you said, the scale is there. And then I think for WhatsApp, I don't know, I feel like the perhaps, you know, they've got a big user base. So in WhatsApp, 65 billion messages are sent a day. In places like India, the whole economy of e-commerce relies on WhatsApp because people are already opted in. They're on it. It's a great contact between business and consumer. And I think perhaps Facebook and Instagram will maintain being the window dressing for brands through influencers and through their own brand pages. But WhatsApp might become this kind of the operational layer, the transactional layer that enables you to create better, you know, create seamless relationships. You don't have to go off to a website to transact. It might be just a mobile number. You know, maybe there'd be that will become a good tracking impact, tracking environment in itself. So although, yeah, fragmentation is quite tricky, I think it's going to create fantastic customer experiences.
But I wonder, Lindsay, you know, the point that you rightly highlight that came up in the blog post, that actually it's such a compelling sort of reason for the two to be, for Instagram and Facebook to be intertwined, the fact that it powers the personalised advertising element of Instagram, Facebook powers the personalised element of Instagram, and then what would those advertisers do if that revenue receded dramatically? That you could see that being used as an argument, right, by certainly by Facebook, but also by lawmakers, by their lawyers, to say, you know, these companies have built an intrinsic link and you therefore can't separate them. And that is arguably what's behind their update of terms and conditions of service in WhatsApp as well, the idea that they're trying to link certainly the data elements of those platforms together to make it harder to pull apart, not just from a, you know, from a practical point of view, but from an ideological point of view, the idea being, yes, okay, we acquired these companies at a time when they were all separate entities, but we've integrated them into this one platform and created an experience, a customer experience, and also created opportunities for businesses and for brands that cannot be realized to the same extent if they were to be separated out. Do you think that's where the DOJ is going to, do you think that's going to be the central point of the argument?
I think it could end up going that way. At the moment, Facebook's central point appears to be, well, you approved it in the first place, so you can't backtrack now. And it's like, yeah, actually we can, because that was a long time ago.
I reckon that's a really good line of defence.
A lot's changed since then. Here's our original letter, which confirms that we can come back and crack the whip 10 years down the line if we want to. So, But I think that that easily could be their first line of defence. The problem that Facebook generally has is that it's Facebook is not an ecosystem in the same way that Apple is, in the same way that Google is. So Facebook, Instagram and WhatsApp are three very disparate businesses. And there's not really kind of, especially WhatsApp feels like an anomaly to Facebook and Instagram. So if you're going to easily get chop one off, it would be WhatsApp. And to Fern's point about WhatsApp being used almost as an e-commerce layer is a fascinating one, because yes, and we had chats with Avis back in the day on the podcast last year, talking about the fact that she WhatsApps her local Greek restaurant to get her deliveries in. And that's how a lot of commerce is happening in Singapore. And it's fascinating to hear kind of that's how we're using it. And we're not seeing so much of that in the UK, but we don't use messaging that way anyway. We don't use the likes of Viber, the likes of Line and everything else the same way that they do in Eastern Europe and in Asia. So I think it's a fascinating opportunity for WhatsApp. I think that you could break up WhatsApp easily and just get rid of them, and they would be able to thrive without the likes of Facebook, without the need for Facebook. But Instagram and Facebook do seem more intrinsically linked. But actually, it could well be the likes of Google and Apple that become the sticking point for Facebook because of the fact that they are doing so much on trying to get rid of mobile IDs, trying to get rid of the cookie. That could actually be more of a detriment to Facebook and how Facebook is able to measure and target across the open web, across the in-app environment, as it stands anyway. So that could make it more difficult for Facebook to be able to share that data across Instagram and Facebook in the long term, because Google and Apple stop them, not because the DOJ does.
You're right, Lindsay. You know, we don't use that as a messaging service in the same way that others do, perhaps in Asia or Eastern Europe, like you say, because Viber is very, very popular for those transactional reasons. But the caveat there is, yet, you know, there's plenty of behaviours that you know, you weren't doing in this modern digital world that you weren't doing one day and you are the next day, you know. Actually, I think if there's one thing that 2020 taught us is that behavior change can be enormously accelerated by, you know, it doesn't always take a significant thing like a pandemic, but it can be enormously accelerated just by other people doing that. And that inspires you to do it as well, right? And, you know, Fern, one minute you're living in central London and the next minute you're living in the countryside.
It's true. I think these different behaviours, I mean, it's something we were talking about before, not being able to get, say, Deliveroo or Uber Eats or something whilst you're out in rural locations. Is that something perhaps that WhatsApp can solve because it becomes more of a localised business and, you know, supporter of local businesses that is underpinned by the kind of the Facebook mantra of marketplace in its development.
Okay, moving on to the third news story of the day. So Martin Sorrell and his colleagues at S4 Capital have been busy acquiring things over the last couple of weeks, which is really interesting to watch from afar. So they've recently acquired Shanghai-based creative agency Tomorrow, and they'll be merging that with Media Monks. And in addition, they also recently acquired Decoded Advertising and Metric Theory. Decoded Advertising will also be subsumed into the Media Monks business, and Metric Theory is going over to the Mighty Hive business. So this is really interesting. You know, it's kicking off 2021 with a pretty upbeat kind of, you know, a level of energy for acquisitions. We know it's been part of Sir Martin Sorrell's strategy right from the start. He's made it very clear that S4 Capital are going to be highly acquisitive for quite some time. He's intent on setting that up as quite a powerful holding group. What I thought was interesting about this is these acquisitions are, you know, unsurprisingly, I suppose, really very much focusing on the core sort of principles of the business of S4 Capital, which is digital marketing assets and anything that's going to help in their pursuit of digital marketing and digital and advertising related to that. And also expansion in fast-growing markets. So it's quite interesting, this acquisition of the company Tomorrow in particular, based in China, because around the press releases associated with this was lots of chat about how quickly the Chinese economy has made a recovery from the blows administered to it by the pandemic last year. And it is fair to say, you know, depending perhaps on which news source that you read, but it is certainly fair to say that they've made a much faster economic recovery than anyone else has anywhere else in the world. And certainly the rest of us are still very much labouring, not the rest of us, a proportion of us, particularly those of us living in the UK and the US and maybe some other European countries or other, are still very much labouring under a deep, dark COVID shadow, and our economies are definitely going to continue to suffer for a little while longer before we start to see things pick up. So it's really interesting to watch how things are unfolding in China. And in addition to that, there's also been a lot of statistics that have been released over the last couple of weeks that the Chinese economy is set to outpace the US economy by 2028, and that's been accelerated by COVID scenario, you know, both China being able to recover quickly and the US being struggling really quite severely with COVID. So I wanted to hear what you guys think of this. We're always interested to watch what Sir Martin Sorrell's up to. Fern, very experienced in the agency world, I'm sure you've got some interesting points of view on this.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely fascinating, and I think it does fire up some positivity for the start of the year, as you said, in terms of how agencies are operating as we go into 2021. APAC is a huge source of growth, and I think it has been for quite a long time. But now, as you said, with glowing figures from the Chinese economy recovery, it's going to be a better, more of a stable environment for us to invest in and to test and learn. Albeit it's a very specific environment with specific tech stacks and specific ways of working, hence why needing to have businesses on the ground. And markets such as India, they've had a huge injection of cash into technology investment. It's predicted that by 2025 that they'll have a greater population than China. So we're going to see a huge volume of growth come out of the markets in APAC, I think, and they're going to be the ones to watch. Whilst we struggle, as you said, with the economic recovery, behaviours and customer confidence, I think, in markets such as the US and the UK. So it doesn't surprise me that that's the area of investment. And I think this integrated model is fascinating. I, for one, when I first started the role at FCB6, had huge imposter syndrome as a strategist, because my background is 16 years in media, data, technology, programmatic. And I thought, how the bloody hell do I do a strategy role? Like, this is ridiculous. But the creativity is an economic multiplier when it comes to experiences for customers, and built on technology and digital and data means that you get to harness the power of all these different platforms worldwide that solve solutions for customers and create great brand experiences for them. So bringing those two elements together, digital, creativity, and being able to put fast production off the back of that, is going to be such a great way of getting into that market and doing it quickly. So it was a really exciting move, both from a location perspective, but also I think in terms of bringing together these kind of the twin powers of data and creativity to create something that's really, really different.
Yeah, right. Fascinating. Lindsay, what's your point of view?
Yeah, what she said.
Covered it all there first.
Yeah, I mean, like, to echo everything Fern said, I think that from looking at the APAC region, there is so much opportunity. Obviously, we've been waxing lyrical about that for years anyway. We know what opportunity there is in APAC, and we're seeing it all the time with the rising middle class, with just a great understanding. There is a lag between what happens in APAC and what happens in the likes of North America and Europe, but it's a lag that is slimming down. That delay is slimming, and there's just massive growth. There's massive population growth. There's massive growth in technology and the use of technology from a consumer perspective, and also from how businesses are using it and being able to apply it as well. But I think that as Fern said, you know, the way that Ethel Capital are approaching this is these two pillars of marketing, which is the creative side and the digital technology side, and being able to bring them together is something we've spoken about in media forever, and how to be able to bring those two together. And there's, you know, we talked about it at ADS events before. Back when I was an agency, it used to be a big topic of conversation. How do we have data-driven creative-driven data, creative-driven advertising, advertising-driven creative? Kind of how does one inform the other, and how do both inform each other? And there's been a lot of work in trying to get creative agencies to work with media agencies, creative agencies to kind of get the mindset of data and technology and digital, and vice versa, for those pillars to understand how creative works. By bringing them together and making them kind of work more harmoniously, you are informing both, and you're coming to a much better decision and much better just much better strategically. It makes much more sense. What I think will be interesting is actually understanding how S4 Capital's clients are using both. Is there actually the integration that from the outside we are assuming is happening? Is that integration happening? So is an S4 Capital client using Mighty Hive and using Media Monks for its creative and its media buying capabilities, or is it just using one and is another client just using the Media Monk side? Even if it is the case that they're just using one side, the impetus is there, right, to be able to go on and say, if you're going to do creative stuff, then, you know, you may as well use us as well, because we are integrated and we all work together. And I find that I find the opportunities there really interesting. I think that them going into APAC makes so much sense. And in particular, like, China is where it's at. And I think that maybe, I don't know how to describe to say this without it sounding really awful, but maybe kind of the economies in APAC that will see a stronger recovery post-COVID, largely because they handle it better in the first place. And they use the SARS model in terms of how they lock down, how they're trying to eliminate the virus rather than just live with it. We decided to go live with it approach and look how that's going. But maybe as well, economies in Europe and in North America, maybe to a certain degree, have more to lose in the first place. So there's going to be a lower base for us to have to rebuild and then be able to grow off top of it. Whereas actually in the Asian economies, maybe they didn't lose as much in the first place because of how they handled the pandemic and because of how their economies have grown in the first place, that they can get back to that base level more easily and then just see massive growth opportunity to the point where we could even see them overtaking us in the next 5 to 10 years. Who knows? But I think that we're going to see a lot of companies going out into APAC because that is definitely where it's at.
Yeah, it's huge. That IPO that for Alibaba that got cancelled, it was going to be the biggest in history.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that is fascinating all on its own, right? Like the size of it, you know, the fact that it got cancelled, that's also fascinating. Yeah, the sort of this the scale of measure and control. But yeah, that is a really interesting point, Lindsay. And I think the same piece of research that I was looking at that was saying the Chinese economy was going to outstrip the US economy by 2028 was also saying the Indian economy is going to outstrip the UK economy by 2024. That's not very far away.
Yeah, no, it was a really interesting time, that transition, and to do it during COVID as well. So I moved into FCB6 in August last year. So all my team is still very much just a screen to me, but I love them dearly. I've thrived in it. And I think the reason for that is understanding customer first, which is enhanced by data, understanding where activation needs to lead these experiences to. And coming at it from coming at creative, not from kind of a platform perspective at the top of a funnel, perhaps, but at the bottom is what user experience. So FCB6, we take CRM, personalization, individualization, we call it, in terms of gathering as much information on people as possible and individualize their brand experiences, truly believing that no one person experiences a brand the same way. And if and when they do, they're experiencing that brand differently throughout times, different times of the day as well. So being able to use data to inform those signals and then intersect that moment with great creativity that's relevant and meaningful enables us to create and stimulate brand growth, which is really exciting. And that can happen, from a brand platform perspective right down to attribution in the funnel. So we're really focusing on, our CTO and CCO are like walk hand in hand together. They're kind of in lockstep to be able to provide like creative platforms that are meaningful. It's an exciting time. We're really focusing on working with customers and our brands and clients to help them understand what the intrinsically links creativity and data together. Half of our agency is a technology consultancy agency. It looks and feels like MarTech and AdTech, and how we stitch all of that together to enable them to create these experiences and they're always kind of customer first. So I've had to just kind of plow my head into what it means to be a customer, looking at journeys and different ways of working and different approaches that I haven't done before. But I'd like to think that the experience that I have had lends itself to being a different flavor of strategist within the company. And that's the great thing about what we do. I mean, everyone's got their strengths and together, I think we create quite a powerful team. So there's a big education coming, and we're launching in the UK as well currently.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, a huge growth trajectory. We're mainly Toronto and US, but have moved into San Fran, Brazil, UK. Then, a few more markets will come in board this year as well. So
that's amazing. Yeah. That's a really interesting story. And I suppose it kind of underpins, well, so there's two things that I think about that I'm thinking off the back of what you've just mentioned. The first is that I can completely understand what an asset it would be to have someone like yourself in a strategy role with so much practical operational experience, and how if you've got a team of people that have got a variety of backgrounds, that must work really well, because that's the way in which you can kind of craft this notion of, interdisciplinary understanding of customers and understanding of the wider purpose of the agency. Then the second thing I was thinking is just sort of backs off something that Lindsay mentioned when we were talking about S4 Capital there, which is, I mean, might it make the stock standard, ad tech event panel conversation about the, data-driven creative, might this make that conversation just a little smoother and a little more real as well, maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to definitely enhance how the application of technology. I did find, working throughout media and coming across so many great initiatives and innovations and startups, we know that this is there's a huge ad tech world, but the practical application of those technologies to create amazing and meaningful experiences that drive business outcomes. We are all about first party data collection, looking at, you know, sales as well as lifetime value. So it's really important that clients are kind of making this step into creating their own destiny instead of, you know, relying on the likes of perhaps Facebook's and Google ecosystems as they had before for that data access, as we've talked about previously. You know, these ecosystems are breaking down. So it's a really exciting place to be in.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I'm already looking forward to a potential sort of newly focused ATS London panel off the back of that. We're hoping to have an in-person event this year. Who knows whether that will be possible, but it's some kind of a wild ambition. So yeah, you know, sort your train times out for that day, Fern. It'll be Sunday in September. Amazing. Well, we've run out of time. Thank you so much, Fern. It was delightful to have a chat with you, hear about what you're up to at FCB6. Thank you very much, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lindsay.
And that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.